paint roller, though the hand of their painter remains unseen. But Branka's stomach clenches as she recognizes the style of this work and sees faceless, paint-strewn figures resolve out of the spreading swirl of colors. They stand around the walls, a watching crowd, a few seated or kneeling while others climb, elbows and knees ajut over the walls themselves. One of these last, a creature that is more radial than symmetrical, with five leg-like limbs, tilts its head sharply towards her. Branka jerks her gaze away. The mural is on every wall, though, and spreading over the ceiling in her peripheral vision. Her heart's pounding. The mural scares her far more than Manbun and his buddies ever will.
"I don't understand," says the woman in white. Her head tilts suddenly, sharply, in a parody of puzzlement.
There's no kindness in her voice anymore.
"Wasn't it you who tried to barge into my toilet stall? Didn't you want to come in and see me? And I left the door open for you, too. Oh, yes, I did. But then you kicked me, and the door shut. Rude."
Her smile vanishes abruptly, replaced by annoyance. Then she sighs.
"But I haven't given up on you, the Bronx. My offer from the toilet still stands. If you work with me, I'll help you. There's no need for you and your favorite individuals to die in the conflagration to come. Or at least, not for some time, as you reckon it. I can see to it that you, the Bronx, are the last to be enfolded. All I need you to do is find him for me."
And she gestures down at the pile of unknowns photographed art. On top is Branka's favorite, still beautiful despite its desecration. Looking at this, at the clean lines that are still visible despite the marker and the distancing second-handness of photography, steadies Branka through her fear. She remembers the day she found the real image. It was a mural that someone had painted onto the wall of a crumbling low-rise in the South Bronx, near one of the number 4 train stations. Another brickyard. Branka can't seem to stay out of them. But then, amid decay and despair, she'd seen this. The self-portrait of a young man who'd drawn it without hands, without paints, from miles away.
The city painted it for him.
That was why the eye for that painting felt different. And now the avatar of New York is somewhere underneath the city, she knows instinctively. Somewhere in the subway tunnels. He's sleeping in the image. And at last, Branka understands what this means. Something has gone wrong. The avatar's sleep is unnatural, enchanted, a desperate last-ditch measure to conserve strength while the city labors through an unexpected crisis. The reason the city is so dangerous, so infested with the woman in white and her ilk, is because all of its defenses are at their lowest ebb and faltering. Why? Why is the city's avatar sleeping?
It comes to her almost painfully fast, as if the city has just been waiting for Branka to ask this question. Because New York is too much for one person to embody. Because its avatar embodied it anyway when the city needed him. And he fought and won, but otherwise the city wouldn't be here. But doing this, using that much power, nearly destroyed him. Now he waits for Branka and the others, the ones who are meant to help him. They must heal him. He can't wake up without their help.
Branka could tell the woman in white this. She doesn't know which subway station the painting depicts, but she could share what she does know. Right now, Murrow Hall's walls are an open doorway into another universe, one that is so fundamentally inimical to everything that Branka is. Human, woman, individual, flesh, matter, three-dimensional, breathing. One step in any direction,
might take her there. A shove, a tug, and even one moment spent there, clashing with its alien atoms and trying to breathe its alien air, will rend her to her core. Is there air? Is that a thing that would exist in such a place? She knows this, as surely as she knows her own names, as surely as she knows her own kin and skin. The enemy is not just at the gates, but at her throat. And if she means to live, she has no choice but to surrender. But there is something else she knows as well as skin. That she is a warrior. Not born, maybe. Chris once told her that she had a gentle soul wrapped in razor wire. But the sharp edges are not her fault. The world trained her to violence, to ferocity, because it hates so much of what she is. This isn't the first time Branka has been surrounded on all sides by those who would invade her, shrink her borders, infect her most quintessential self, and leave only sanitized, deadened debris in their wake. It's not even the first time she's had the power to fight back. This is just the first time it's happened, since she became the goddamn Bronx. No, Branka says to the woman in white. I don't fucking think so. The woman sighs. Oh, I'm sorry then. She makes a little twitching movement with one hand. Something behind Branka makes a sound. It's nothing she can easily describe. At its baseline, a low gulping, almost musical double reverberation, like something electronic. Except this is organic, she knows. It is the hunting cry of a beast that has no voice. An organism that has never known laws of physics congruent with her own. And it is close. The artistes, sycophants that they are, snicker or start jeering. They can see whatever's coming for her, she guesses. Though 15 abruptly blanches as he gets a good look at it. He steps back quickly shaken, and looks away. By the angle of his gaze before he retreated, Branka knows the thing is right behind her. And Branka laughs. She can't help it. Some of this is nerves, the rest is fury. These people, they have come into her burrow, her territory, and ripped down good art. They've tried to force her to accept their disgusting, mediocre bullshit instead. And here is this white woman, who is not a white woman at all, but who has tried to manipulate mechanisms of power against Branka, just like the worst of them, demanding that Branka capitulate. Like fuck she will. The woman in white frowns at Branka's laughter. I don't know. Who the hell you think you are, Branka says, and she is spreading her arms. And I don't know what you are, but you don't know who I am if you're coming at me with this weak-ass game. The woman's eyes narrow. You're the Bronx. Yeah, Branka says, and I'm also the one who got all the knowledge of how this works. She is setting her feet. The others probably don't know how to do this yet, but I do. A wind has begun to blow within the hall, stirring papers hanging along the center's corridors. Branka does not notice. The world has divided into two. Murrow Hall, where the woman in white curses as jittering figures amid the wall mural draw back in what Branka suspects is alarm, and the other New York. There is a Murrow Hall in the other New York, too, but what has changed is its perspective and focus. Now Branka stands expansive, mountainous. She has legs bolted to a million foundations and arms of 100 million joints of rebar. The flesh that fills the gaps is the soil where 1,000 generations of Branka's mothers grew and thrived. which has been invaded and poisoned and built over again and again. But it survives still. Survives strong.
And before her, small and insignificant, cavorts a white blankness of a thing. It's dangerous, that much she knows. It can hurt her very badly. Both of her. All of her. It can drag her true self into a place where the completeness of her can be killed for all time, never to recover or be reborn. That will destroy the Bronx. Without the Bronx, all of New York will die.
So Branka touches a steel-clad toe to the ground, lightly as any dancer. It lands with the pounding force of 10,000 block parties, boom cars, and drum circles, and sends forth a wave of energy that obliterates everything in its path. Everything that's not of New York, that is. Around the woman in white and Branka, the mural is suddenly empty of people. The alt artistes have fallen to the ground, unconscious or groaning, because Branka's manifestation has killed every tendril of white in the center. It was in them. It was in the bathroom, Branka notes with belated chagrin, infesting the third stall. Damn it, she should have double-checked. It has grown into the electrical system and begun crawling up inside of the stairwell walls, damaging the children's murals along the way. But now that contamination is gone. Now it's just the two of them, Living City and Eldritch Abomination, face to face and ready for the showdown to come. Today? Maybe. Branka waits to see. And after a long, pent moment, the woman in white exhales. She is unharmed by Branka's attack, which is peculiar. However, she says, I'd hoped to recruit you to my cause. Her voice is soft. Humility, maybe? But Branka knows better than to try to interpret anything she does by normal human standards. We have so much in common, you and I. We both want to survive. We've both had to stand on our own, ally-less and undervalued, lost in the shadow of our supposed betters. We've both chosen to do what's right, regardless of what it will cost us in the end. Branka shakes her head, unwilling to feel sympathy anymore. I'm not a settler from another damn dimension. No. You just threaten the existence of an infinity of dimensions, and more lives than your species has numbers to count. White snaps. Branka frowns, but then the woman sighs. Oh, I suppose I cannot blame you, however. We all do what we must. Very well. I can't destroy you. Yet. We'll meet again, perhaps, when circumstances have changed. With this, the woman in white jerks her head a little. The murals on the walls, figureless swirls of muted color now, vanish, rolling up into nothingness as readily as they appeared. There is one last soft behind Branka, before it too fades into silence. She would swallow to relieve her dry throat in the thing's wake, but it's important to show no weakness right now. She's the Bronx.
The Bronx don't back down.
The woman in white inclines her head. There is respect in this.
My minions won't bother you again, she says.
Until the day that all masks are set aside.
Of course.
Of course, Branka says wryly.
Minions. It's almost comedy.
Branka lip points toward the artistes, not bothering to look at them.
And them?
The woman glances at them. Branka gets the sense that she is genuinely puzzled by Branka's question.
I have no more need of those parts. Consume or repurpose them as you please. They're very malleable.
Then she turns without another word and steps forward.
It's as if she's stepped into a hole in the air that Branka cannot see. First, the front half of her is gone, and then she picks up her trailing foot, and the latter half vanishes. Branka edges forward cautiously, but when she steps forward and swipes at the air with her hand passes through empty air. Any opening that was there has sealed itself. Exhaling, Branka straightens and turns to the artistes, only to find Veneza just beyond the pile of men, staring at her with wide, shocked eyes. Branka considers her protege, putting her hands on her hips.
You okay?
She asks. The look on her face means that Veneza must have witnessed at least some of that whole confrontation. She's going to have questions.
Well, I mean, just the sight of something awful and incomprehensible isn't going to send me off frothing at the mouth,
Veneza says. It's nonchalant, but there is a shaken note to her voice nonetheless.
I'm from Jersey.
Branka coughs a laugh.
Thought I told you to run if you saw weird shit.
I saw these asshats.
Veneza lip points at the alt artistes. That's a Lenape thing she's picked up from Branka. One of the artistes sprawls face down, and Branka can't see him breathing, so she really hopes he isn't dead. The other two are almost spooning. 15, who's still conscious, but fetal and groaning with his hands pressed over his face, is the little spoon. It would be cute if they weren't racist, sexist, homophobic dipshits.
So I came to make sure you were okay. And then I see...
She falters a little. Her gaze flicks to the wall behind Branka, where the lurked.
Yeah, that would have been the time to leave.
Couldn't think.
Veneza shakes her head and presses the heels of her hands to her eyes for a moment. Branka tenses, but Veneza makes no move to tear her eyes out. The lexicon warns that that can happen.
Fuck, I'm gonna have nightmares for days.
So that's what's after you? For real? I mean, just like
working through esos residuos de peli. That white bitch?
Branka tries, she really tries, to be a role model sometimes. Occasionally. Okay, not often.
We shouldn't use bitch to refer to women in the pejorative.
I'm using it to refer to a non-human non-woman.
So, is this whole scheme like an extra-dimensional shakedown or some kind of fuck shit like that? Is that what I am seeing?
Veneza's voice has gone more than shaky. It is seismic. She's trembling, too. And now her hands are rubbing tears from her closed eyes. Branka sighs and goes over to her.
Skippy the tentacle monster sends her little bigot fuck boys to harass you on the internet? Like, is that how Lovecraftian horror works now? Because I can't.
Branka just holds her. It's what they both need for a while. Then they hear feet on the stairwell, and one of the keyholders pushes open the door. It's Yelima the glass sculptor with the abusive ex-husband. She's carrying an aluminum baseball bat. Two other keyholders, both homeless 20-somethings, hunch behind her, peering out at Branka. Yelima takes in the sprawled artistes and Veneza's visible distress. Her nostrils flare. Branka shakes her head quickly, though she's not quite sure what Yelima is signaling that she intends to do, or what she's telling Yelima not to do. She hopes it's do not use bat, or at least... not for now.
Call the police, she tells Yelima. I'm gonna go pull the videos from our security cameras for them.
Make a copy,
Veneza snaps. She's better now, though her eyes are red and she's still a bit twitchy.
What's wrong with you? Make a copy and a backup copy and a hidden backup copy. NYPD gets the originals and you'll never see them again.
I don't have time for all that.
Branka begins, and of course, as soon as she says this, Veneza makes a disgusted noise and heads toward the reception desk.
You call the police then, she tells Branka. I'll make sure they don't fuck up the video evidence. Yelima, hit the artists if they give you lip.
Then she's off. Yelima comes over, a wry look on her face.
You okay?
Branka, who has closed her eyes for a moment to disengage with the waiting, ready martial spirit of her burrow, lets out a long, slow breath and then nods.
Ooh, yeah.
Surprisingly, under the circumstances. But she is. It takes the police a fucking hour to show up. It's still the South Bronx. By then, one of the artistes, Doc, has come too, although he seems more confused and high than anything else. He sits shivering against the wall while Yelima watches him with a taut attention born of experience. He keeps saying that he's cold and asking how he got there. Branka supposes that whatever the woman in white did to him could have affected his memory. But she also knows that the woman in white could not have used Doc and company unless there was something sympathetic, synchronistic, within all of them. So even though Man Bun might actually be comatose or catatonic instead of just unconscious, Branka can't muster much in the way of pity for him. She just hopes he doesn't die in her gallery. When the cops do finally show up, they try to talk Branka into not pressing charges. The artists are nice white boys from well-connected families, it turns out, caught breaking and entering by a bunch of hippie brown women. Of course, the cops don't want the smoke they're going to get from these families' lawyers or the press. Vanessa gives them a thumb drive featuring footage of all three men crowbarring the center's shuttered exhibit door. The only door in the place that isn't on the alarm system, because a sensor got damaged a while back, which they knew somehow. The footage shows them sneaking in, one carrying a visible can of lighter fluid. Vanessa's also added time-stamped photos that she took of Morrow Hall, and the piled-up marker-vandalized paintings. Branka makes sure the cops note the smell of lighter fluid, still very detectable on the absorbent photo paper. One of the cops makes noises about how it could interfere with the investigation if Branka shows the video footage anywhere, like online or to the news. Branka smiles and says,
You and the DA handle things the way they need to be handled, and we won't have to.
So finally, they take the artists away in zip cuffs, or, in Man Bun's case, on an ambulance stretcher. By this point, it's dawn. The key holders are all up doing what they can to help put the center back together. At Branka's request, they put up the unknown self-portrait again, despite the damage. Takes more than a marker to destroy something that amazing. Vanessa runs out for donuts and coffee, and as word spreads on social media about the break-in, other artists and patrons from around the borough start showing up. They bring brooms and tools. One guy, whose uncle runs an ironwork shop, shows up with the business's truck, carrying several beautifully worked iron gates. He measures and mumbles, but is eventually able to fit one that can replace the busted exhibit door shutter. It will be better than anything the center's budget could afford. He's installing it for free. When Branka finally takes a moment to sit down in her cluttered office with the door closed, she puts her hands over her face and cries for a minute. Then someone knocks, and she knows it's either an emergency or one of the many strangers in the place right now, because the center staff knows better than to bother Branka while the office door is shut. Scrubbing the back of a fist over her eyes, she grabs a tissue for her nose and calls, muffled,
What?
The door opens, and three people stand there. Even if Branka hadn't been raw inside, she would know them by the sudden, almost painful ring of recognition that sounds throughout her soul. They are kin, battle companions, the missing fragments of herself. They are Manhattan, Brooklyn, and Queens. And they're grinning, ostensibly elated at having found Branka.
What the shit do you want?
Branka demands. Chapter 10. Make Staten Island great against Sao Paulo. Aislinn is up on the roof again, gazing at the distant city in the night, when her mother scares the life out of her by touching her from behind. She yelps loudly enough for her voice to echo from the nearby houses and turns to glare at her mother.
Mom, are you trying to give me a heart attack?
Sorry, her mother says. But are you sure you should be up here? That allergy attack you had.
Aislinn has spent the past 24 hours on Benadryl to try to reduce the hives she picked up at the ferry station. They're mostly gone now, and not as itchy, though the Benadryl has made her dreamy-headed and slow. Sitting on the roof is one of her favorite pastimes ordinarily, but between the drug and the soft, constant song of the city, the experience has become sublime.
I'm good, Mom. It feels nice out here. The wind's so cool, and you can smell the harbor even from here.
It feels so good, in fact, that on impulse she adds, sit down. Look at the city with me. The roof of the Houlihan home isn't much more than an access door and some satellite dishes, though her father jokingly calls it their rooftop bar. Aislinn's put two folding lawn chairs out here, and she knows that her father often takes advantage of them because she has to pick up his beer bottles and put away his binoculars whenever she comes up. This is the first time her mother has ever climbed up, however. So she watches with some interest, as Kendra, she's thought of her mother as this since her teens, because it's what her father calls her, settles gingerly into one of the lawn chairs. It creaks and slides back a little beneath her weight, which makes her yelp, then laugh nervously.
Sorry, Kendra says again. I don't like heights.
But then she falls silent, gazing at the cityscape. Aislinn is pleased to see her mother's face, too, relax into wonder. Manhattan is scary to contemplate up close, and apparently full of bees, but from this safe distance, it is a jewel to behold. They sit for a few moments in companionable silence, and then her mother says,
so, did you make it to the city yesterday?
Aislinn starts, her heart constricting, though she doesn't know why. Aislinn does not understand her mother. Kendra is basically an older version of herself, black-haired and slender, and so pale that sometimes there's a green cast to her skin. Aislinn often finds herself hoping that she'll grow up to be as beautiful as her mother, since Kendra has only fine threads of gray hair and a few minute wrinkles, even in her 50s. Black Irish holds the years well. However, Aislinn does not want her mother's eyes. All of Kendra's age lives here. Not in lines, but in constant darting flickers and a slow, sad weariness. Back when Aislinn was a teenager, she often thought of her mother as dull. Since then, Aislinn has come to understand that women sometimes have to pretend to be dull so that the men around them can feel sharper. Adult Aislinn has had to do the same thing with increasing frequency as she's grown older. So she and her mother are finally beginning to become friends. But it's fragile, like any friendship formed amid stress. And her mom has never intruded so far into territory that Aislinn regards as inviolably hers before. She shifts a little, trying not to show her discomfort, although the rickety lawn chair betrays her by creaking loudly.
How did you know?
Kendra shrugs a little.
You usually take your car to go shopping. The bus is so slow. But NYPD photographs license plates at the ferry station.
And her father almost found out anyway because of her panic attack. Aislinn sighs in careful frustration. And then she can't think of anything else to say. Her mother has also lived nearly her whole life on Staten Island. How can Aislinn say, I just wanted to leave you and Daddy and everything I've ever known to go to the city you've spent years warning me against? And for what? To meet total strangers who are part of me, part of New York. And I am part of New York, and I don't think I want to be, but I am. And then Kendra destroys Aislinn's entire image of her and perception of herself with a single sentence. Really hoped you would make it, she says quietly. Aislinn flinches hard enough to make the chair shift back. She stares at her mother. Kendra offers another of those tired smiles, though she doesn't look at Aislinn while she does it, just keeps her gaze on the city. Wanted to be a concert pianist when I was young, she says, further flooring Aislinn. I was really good. Got a scholarship to Juilliard and everything. Wouldn't have had to pay a dime except MTA fare every day. She sighs softly. I mean, I was really good. Fucking amazing. Aislinn can count on one hand the number of times that her mother has dropped an F-bomb over the entirety of her life. But that isn't the thing that's jolted her the most. I've never seen you touch a piano. You don't even listen to music on the radio except when Dad does. Kendra smiles a little, with just one corner of her mouth, while the rest of her face remains its mournful, immobile self. She doesn't say anything. Aislinn can't believe this. Because your parents said no? Her maternal grandparents are dead now. Heart attack for Grandpa, undiagnosed liver cancer for Grammy. But Aislinn remembers them as being very traditional. Stolid, no meat on Fridays, Catholics. Aislinn's strongest memory of them is Grammy telling her how she should dress and carry herself if she wanted a good husband. Aislinn had been 7 when she died. I was pregnant, love. Married your father not a month after I got the acceptance letter. Aislinn knows about this. Connell, the brother she should have had, but did not due to a miscarriage. Aislinn was born a few years later. No one really knows if Connell was going to be a boy, of course. He was a blob with flippers by the time he left the building. But when her father drinks, he talks about what he could have had. A brother in arms to help the family face this terrible world. Instead of a daughter, there's only another useless thing to protect. Aislinn knows that the idea of working motherhood is anathema to both her parents. But since Connell wasn't, and it would have only meant working wifehood, Aislinn frowns. You still could have gone, couldn't you? If she has tiptoed around Connell for years. Her father still grieves. Her mother keeps her own counsel on the matter, because that's what women have to do sometimes, she has always told Aislinn. I meant to go. Your father wasn't much help with, anything. But I was determined to find a way to make it work. Her mother smiles again, that little half-a-mouth smile, less than a quarter of her face. Her gaze is distant, somewhere well beyond the city. That's why I had the abortion. Aislinn's mouth drops open. But afterward, he was so heartbroken that I... Kendra sighs, the smile fading. I decided it was right that I should give something up too. God. Aislinn has to swallow hard to muster words. You never told Dad? Why would I? So many answers wrapped up in that one. Why would she tell a conservative, sun-hungry man
that she'd aborted his baby? Why tell a husband that it was his fault for forcing her to choose between one dream and another? And then there is the matter of how he would have reacted. Aislinn shifts again, realizing she's drawn back from her mother a little. She didn't mean to. It's just a lot. But her mother isn't done.
So I hoped you would make it out. I thought at least one of us should, I don't know, see the world. Try new things. That's why I sent for those brochures from colleges in the city.
She grimaces a little as Aislinn stares at her again in shock. Aislinn had gotten in so much trouble for those brochures. Her father had assumed she'd requested them. He'd ranted for most of the night about how terrible the city was, and how much he'd sacrificed to keep her safe, and how it was her choice, of course. But he expected her to make good choices. A week later, she'd enrolled in the College of Staten Island.
Jesus Christ,
Aislinn mutters. And then she winces, realizing she's forgotten herself. Her mother has always grumbled about blasphemy when her father says the same thing.
Yeah, that was a real shit show, wasn't it?
Her mother says. Okay, Iceland's gonna stroke out any minute now.
Sorry.
Finally, though, her mom gets to her feet and turns to Aislinn. All at once, Aislinn finds herself imagining a different version of her mother. Still the same woman, still limbed by the distant light of the city, but wearing a stylish little black dress and with her hair elegantly coiffed instead of just a fraying bun at the back of her neck. The way she's seen concert pianists dress on TV. There would be fewer lines in her face, Aislinn decides, considering this stranger who has been her mother for 30 years. Lighter circles under her eyes, if any. And her eyes would be just beautiful, instead of beautiful and tired and sad. Then the moment passes, and Kendra is just Kendra again.
Don't stay here, she says to Aislinn. Just don't. If the city calls you, Lynn, listen to it and go.
Then she pats Aislinn on the shoulder and heads for the roof access door. Aislinn sits there a long hour more, staring not at the city, but at the door that her mother passed through. As Aislinn comes downstairs, she realizes someone else is in the dining room with her father. That's unusual enough. Aislinn's father doesn't like intruders on his territory. But when she leans around the door to see who it is, she is surprised to find her father sitting at the dining table with a man of about Aislinn's age, whose entire appearance screams Antifa, or commie, or weed head, or any number of other things that Matthew Houlihan has called young men who look like this. The young man is wearing perfectly rectangular, black-rimmed glasses and a conspicuously old-fashioned mustachio, curled and waxed at the tips. His arms, mostly bare, he seems to be wearing only a short-sleeved button-down with suspenders, the kind of outfit her father has called gay on other men, display unimpressive biceps and such a profusion of tattoos that Aislinn cannot make any one of them out. He sits close to Aislinn's father, kitty corner at the table edge, showing him something on a tablet computer. They're both snickering at whatever it is, like small boys at CCD lessons on Sundays. Her father, a broad man even up to his balding pate, is literally twice the younger man's size. It's like watching a bulldog snicker at a dachshund's jokes. Then they both look up, and Aislinn is caught staring. Her father immediately beams and beckons her into the room.
Hey, yeah, Apple, come on in. I want you to meet a friend.
Aislinn comes in, trying not to frown so that she can be polite, but her father does not have friends. He has guys from work, who are cops as well, and to judge by his comments about them, her father regards most of those as rivals for the rank of detective, which he has been striving to achieve for most of Aislinn's life. He goes drinking and occasionally to ball games with them, however, and this apparently serves as enough of a substitute for friends that he's never sought anything else. And yet, here's her father, grinning as he says, "This is Conall McGinnis." And then he laughs, as Aislinn cannot help widening her eyes at the name.
Good Irish name, right? Always liked that one.
Conall laughs too.
Blame my father.
Matthew chuckles and slaps him on the back, while Conall regards Aislinn.
Very nice to meet you, Aislinn. I've heard a lot about you.
Hopefully all good.
Aislinn banters by rote, trying not to squirm. She's gotten better at this since she was a child, when she would simply stand before strangers without speaking, having frozen up. But she's still not good at it. Usually her father knows this and gives her plenty of warning before he brings a stranger home for her sake.
Nice to meet you too, thanks.
And to her father, just because the curiosity is killing her, she adds,
Is this, somebody else from work?
Work? Hey, no.
Her father's still smiling, but all at once, Aislinn knows that he's lying. But what is the lie? Conall doesn't look like a cop. He doesn't feel like a cop. Although Aislinn's cop-dar is understandably limited in its scope. But maybe Conall is a friend of cops in general.
We're just working on a thing together, kiddo. A hobby,
Conall adds, and then he and Aislinn's father dissolve into boyish snickering again. Aislinn has no idea what's so funny. When they recover, Conall is the picture of pleasantry.
Apple, huh? That's cute. I figured you'd have a nickname based on Aislinn. Dreams, dreamer, dreamy, you know.
That's the meaning of Aislinn's Gaelic name, which Aislinn looked up in a book once when she was a child.
You really are a true son of Aislinn, huh?
Conall grins. Aislinn's father nods approvingly and adds,
Apple? Course she's my little apple, here in the Big Apple. I started calling her that when she was little and she loved it.
Aislinn has always loathed this nickname. Do you, need anything to eat or drink, Conall, Dad?
We're good, kid. Hey, but Conall, Aislinn's a great cook. Even better than her mother, Kendra!
It's a sudden bellow that makes Aislinn jump. But for once, her father isn't angry. Kendra appears immediately, and Matthew gestures vaguely toward the back of the house.
Make up the guest room, babe. Connell's going to stay with us for a couple of days.
Kendra nods, nodding again to Conall in lieu of a greeting. Then she hesitates.
Lynn and I already ate, though.
And the leftovers are already put up for the night, if Conall's hungry. It's also a commentary on the fact that Matthew came home later than usual tonight. Matthew's smile vanishes almost instantly, and Aislinn's belly clenches almost as fast.
Did I ask when you ate?
She is relieved when Conall straightens a little, drawing both her parents' attention back to himself.
Thank you for looking after me,
he says to Kendra, and flashes a charming smile.
Wow. Matt didn't lie, Mrs. Houlihan. You really are beautiful.
Kendra blinks in surprise, and Aislinn's father, who normally hates being called Matt, laughs and companionably whacks Conall again.
Trying to sweet talk my wife, huh? What the hell, you?
Just like that, everything's laughs again. Aislinn looks at Kendra without quite intending to. She's learned over the years that she and her mother cannot appear to be allied, even if they are. But Kendra seems just as puzzled by the whole situation. She goes off to make up the guest bed, and Aislinn decides to beat a retreat as well. Just before Aislinn completes her turn away, however, a flicker of movement snags her attention. She jumps and looks back sharply, frowning. Connell and her father have returned their attention to whatever's on the tablet, and they've dropped their voices to continue talking. Just like best friends. All very abnormally normal. What was that movement, though? There, on the back of Connell's neck. Something long and thin and white sticks up from somewhere around the 6th or 7th cervical vertebrae and just above his crisp shirt collar. One of those weird little tendrils that the woman in white kept putting on people and objects. Connell glances up again and raises his eyebrows at her stare. Something wrong? Nothing, Aislinn blurts, and then she nods something farewell-like before hurrying upstairs to her room. By 3 a.m., it's clear to Aislinn that she's not going to get any sleep. As she's done with previous bouts of insomnia, she gets up and heads into the backyard. There's nothing here but the family pool, which her father installed 10 years ago, and which Aislinn swum in maybe twice. It isn't that she doesn't like swimming. It's that she can't stand the fear that someone might be ogling her in her swimsuit. Even though there's a 12-foot wooden privacy fence around the entire backyard, it's not rational, but neither is her fear of the Staten Island Ferry. But even though the pool is useless for swimming, it's not bad for meditating. If moping beside a pool while clad in jammies and her favorite Danny the Dolphin plush slippers qualifies as meditation. This time, however, she's been out there for about 5 minutes, mournfully contemplating the distant, increasingly desperate call of the city. When something shifts beside her, she jumps and whirls to find her father's house guest Connell sitting in a poolside lounger not 5 feet away. He's been there the whole time, Aislinn realizes with some chagrin. She was just so caught up in her thoughts that she didn't notice. He's muzzy-faced as he yawns now and blinks at her, and there are lines from the lounger's straps on one cheek. He must have been asleep. There's dried drool on one side of his mouth. Aislinn doesn't laugh at this, because she's also a little appalled to see that he's wearing nothing but a pair of her father's old pajama pants. He's double-tied them, but they're still tent-like on him. As he's without a shirt, she sees now that he also sports a farmer's tan and a series of additional tattoos across his chest and belly that are a lot less ambiguous than the ones on his arms. One's an older, nicely done Irish Trinity knot over which the number 14 and a separate 88 have been etched in jagged, more amateurish lines. She remembers reading something about those numbers. And though she can't recall what they're supposed to mean exactly, she doesn't think it's anything good. A couple of the tats are semi-comprehensible outlines of what look like Norse gods. They're very muscular. Part of Aislinn is mildly offended by the conflation of Nordic stuff with Celtic, because the Vikings were invaders. But it is the tattoo on his left pectoral that makes her tense up. There, right over his heart, is a thickly etched swastika. So maybe this isn't really the time to quibble over mixed mythological metaphors.
Well, you haven't run screaming. Your dad did say you are a true daughter of the Isle.
What's Ireland got to do with... Aislinn gestures at the swastika.
Just that there aren't enough girls like you out there making the right choices.
He reaches down, and belatedly Aislinn sees the bottles next to the lounger, her father's favorite beer brand. In addition to this, there's a metal flask surrounded by several airplane-sized bottles of harder liquor. All appear empty. Aislinn cannot see the white tendril on his neck from here. Can the woman in white watch her through it? Is she part of him somehow?
Aislinn is groping for a way to ask, did she tell you her name too?
When Connell sets the bottle down and says,
ever fucked a black guy?
What?
Her thoughts freeze. The question doesn't make sense on any level. That he would ask such a thing of a stranger, that he would ask it of her of all people, that he would ask it of a supposed friend's daughter, that he would put that string of words together in that order.
What?
You know, ever take a swing on the old jungle gym? Or made the beast with a wet back?
As if it's the funniest thing in the world.
I'm just saying, if your father's trying so hard to set you up with me, which he is, I should know what kind of goods I'm buying, right? I mean, you're a pretty girl, but you're from Staten Island.
He grins as if this is supposed to mean something in particular.
I'm just asking who's, stretched you out, broken you in.
His eyes rove her body while he talks. Aislinn suddenly feels that her worn oversized t-shirt and faded dolphin pajama pants are the height of indecency. She should have put on a robe. That's why he's talking to her like this, because she's dressed like a whore. She should have... He laughs again, and this time it's lazy and friendly.
Calm down. I'm just fucking with you. I tried to tell your dad that you weren't really my type, but...
He picks up the flask, which is open, and swigs from it. Then grimaces as if its contents have burned his throat going down. She needs to leave. He's gross and drunk. But the words are actually starting to anger her now that her shock has given way to comprehension. She is here in her own home. He is a guest, and he speaks to her like this.
I'm definitely not your type, she says.
Then she turns her back on him, but does not leave because she refuses to look like she's fleeing from him even if she wants to. He snickers. It's infuriating.
Hey, eyes, I'm sorry. Friends, okay? Let's be friends. Hey, I want to show you something.
When she deliberately does not turn, he shifts a little, making the lounger scrape the concrete. At this, she jumps and whirls because some part of her is abruptly afraid that he's going to get up and... What? Now she's being irrational. Her father is a cop and a shout away. Connell wouldn't dare. But Connell is still in the lounger. He's sprawled out more, in fact, spreading his legs and planting his feet on the pool deck and... And that isn't a bottle tenting his pants. Aislinn flinches and starts walking away, hot-faced and disgusted. Connell catches her hand as she goes past, to her astonishment.
Sure you wanna go?
Let go of me,
she snarls.
Look, eyes, he says.
He's dropped his voice into something low and persuasive.
We both know you'll die in this house if some guy doesn't marry you away.
That, Aislinn freezes, that's... He reads the horrified acknowledgement of reality in her shock and grins.
And we both know you've never done anything with any guy, let alone any big fat jungle dicks. I've seen your type. Good Catholic girls too scared to do shit. Wanna know a secret? Nobody likes virgin's eyes. It doesn't make you pure or special. Just a shitty lay whenever somebody finally gets around to you.
His hand, already tight enough that she's going to have to struggle to break his grip, pulls her down a little.
Daddy's girl, still living at home, never had a boyfriend, but you wanna leave, don't you? You dream about having a real life. You want to get away from this shitty island. Be somebody, right?
Let go of me,
Aislinn says again, but this time it's weak because some of what he's said has struck entirely too close to home. She's shaking too, and she hates it, because he can feel that. But she's surprised to realize in a sudden epiphany that she isn't shaking out of fear. He's said a lot of things that are accurate, but this shitty island? Her hand twitches in his, and he tightens his grip in response. He thinks she's trying to get away. She isn't.
Shitty? So here's your ticket,
he says, bumping his hips up so that his erection bounces an obscene suggestion.
Your dad just loves me. But you don't want to be his anymore, do you? Be your own woman. Suck my dick. Or we can even get started on grandkids for him if you want. I got a fat cream pie already up in here.
He grins and then fumbles at the drawstring of his pants, trying to tug them down.
Or if you are really committed to the virginity thing, anal's good too. Doesn't hurt at all.
He's revolting. Aislinn cannot understand why her father has befriended this creature, brought him home, put him up in their house. Or rather, a part of her is especially shaken because she does understand why. Because on some level, her father is this man. She cannot imagine Matthew Houlihan being this crass with her mother, or else her maternal grandparents would never have let Kendra marry him. But beneath her father's veneer of traditional respectability, he is also a beer-swilling, controlling boor. Aislinn loves her father. Of course she does. But Connell is right on one level. Her whole life, Aislinn has had to scrape and struggle to maintain her own emotional real estate. If she doesn't leave this house soon, her father will snatch it all up and double the rent on anything he doesn't want her to feel. Connell is very, very wrong, however, about something important. He thinks that the meek, shy girl that her father has described and whom he is currently terrorizing is all there is to Aislinn. It isn't. The rest of her is as big as a city. I told you, she says to Connell, finally jerking her hand free, to let go. On the last word, a sphere of pure force balloons outward from Aislinn's skin. It presses Connell into the lounger, and then, as he inhales in shock, bodily lifts both him and the lounger, then flings them all the way across the pool deck. Man and furniture smash through the wooden fence amid a clatter of splinters and the snap of boards, and one strangled, belated, what the fuck? Aislinn straightens at once, her eyes going to the cameras edging the pool area. Everything that happens everywhere else happens here, too, she murmurs quickly. It is her father's favorite saying. But at least here, people try to be decent. Try to be decent. Something ripples around her, an edit of perception. The recording lights on the cameras flicker a bit. And as Connell struggles to his feet, covered in leaves from the neighbor's euonymus hedge and bits of shattered wood from the fence, staring at Aislinn in something like terror, she glares at him. I wasn't here, she snaps. Then she steps over his mess and walks out of the yard. She doesn't know where she's going. It doesn't matter where she's going. She's got no money and no ID and can't go far anyway because she's walking in puffy slippers shaped like dolphins. But as she walks, her limbs moving with tight, brisk efficiency, her jaw full of tension, she feels the island, her island, editing perception around her.
No one notices or pays attention to a lone young woman walking down the middle of the street because her street has no sidewalks. It's not that they don't see her. The drivers of the cars that pass or the neighbors who chance to look outside after hearing a loud noise from the Houlihan house. It's just that as they notice her, something else catches their attention. A movement in the trees, a car rolling past with speakers blaring, a bus in the distance stopping on screechy brakes. The front door of the house opening as Matthew Houlihan comes out with a sawed-off shotgun in one hand, heading around to the side of the house where the fence has been shattered. He doesn't see Aislinn either, even though she's only maybe 20 feet away in that moment. He sees what she wants him to see. Everything that happens everywhere else happens on Staten Island, too. But here people try not to see the indecencies, the domestic violence, the drug use. And then, having denied what's right in front of their eyes, they tell themselves that at least they're living in a good place full of good people. At least it's not the city. And at least Aislinn is not at this very moment being raped by a man in whom her father sees himself. This, and the fact that she's heard her father make fun of rape victims, is why she doesn't bother to tell her father what Connell did. This is why, if her father checks the video feed from the cameras, he'll see an indistinct figure, not Aislinn, standing by the pool, who then gets into a struggle with Connell and runs away after bodily throwing Connell through the fence. Evil comes from elsewhere, Matthew Houlihan believes. Evil is other people. She will leave him this illusion, mostly because she envies his ability to keep finding comfort in simple black and white views of the world. Aislinn's ability to do the same is rapidly eroding. This is why she stops on the corner with her head down and her fists clenched and her shoulders tight. She's sucking in breaths to try to get a hold of herself and trying not to cry. It's late enough that the street that winds past her neighborhood is quiet. A car passed a moment ago, and the next one coming is at least a mile behind it. Here in this liminal silence, Aislinn can be afraid and angry and bitter about all the forces that have conspired to make her what she is. She can wish for better. She can... The car that's been coming along the road for the past minute or so reaches her. It's going slowly. And as it gets closer, it slows more. Finally, it stops right before her, the driver leaning over to roll down the passenger side window. Aislinn tenses, bracing herself for the catcall or solicitation. The man inside is ferociously lean, dark-haired, and something other than white. He's got a lit cigarette held tightly between his lips as he stares at her for a moment. Then he says, "Staten Island?" She jerks upright, and for an instant, the world changes. High-rises wheel past, buses squealing between them, docks and piers bristling into a defensive configuration. Before her looms a foreign, neon-bright skyline so immense and building-studded that it casts her into shadow. And then it is only the thin brown man again, who is staring at her with narrowed, cynical, knowing eyes. "Get in," says this total stranger. Aislinn starts toward his car without a second thought. Before she can reach for the door handle, however, there is a stir at her feet and a playing card quick shuffle of realities around her, and then suddenly curling, lashing white flower fronds whip up from the earth between her and the car. Aislinn stops, her eyes widening, and the man curses, throwing the car into reverse and trying to back away from them. Still growing, the fronds swiftly become taller than Aislinn herself. Then they lunge away from Aislinn toward the car, which they rapidly rise to surround and entangle. She can hear them slapping and
hissing as they hit and sear at its chassis. And as Aislinn stumbles back from the frond mass, the woman in white catches her from behind with tight hands on her shoulders, leaning forward to peer into her face.
Phew!
He almost got you. Are you all right?
What?
No, let go!
Aislinn shakes her off reflexively. Where the hell did she come from? In the same instant, from within the lashing tangle of white flower fronds, there is a strange knot sound, a vibration, but with no tone that her ears can detect. It sluices through part of the thicket of fronds, dissolving them, and then the car lurches forward with a screech of tires. Out of control, it skids a little onto the grassy slope off the main road, then stops, brake lights glaring. Aislinn barely notices, almost tripping over her puffy slippers in her haste to scramble away from both the remaining fronds and the woman in white. The woman looks wholly different from the last time Aislinn saw her, 2 days ago at the ferry station. This time, she's wearing a tracksuit, which makes it easy to see that she's much plumper and shorter, with her white hair streaked here and there with a few strands of faded bottle auburn, now in a shoulder-length soccer mom bob. Her face is not the same woman, Aislinn realizes with a frisson of shock. This is someone wholly different, and yet she is also the woman in white. Every instinct that Aislinn possesses identifies her as the same woman from before. Same manic energy, same bright, too earnest eyes as she holds up hands as if to soothe a skittish beast. Aislinn's mind thinks of a name, but flinches away before she can recall all three syllables. Or is it two? Three, but slurred, maybe. It starts with an R. Rosie. She'll stick to Rosie. Doesn't matter.
Stay away from me!
Aislinn snaps. She's shaking. In her mind's eye, she is seeing that delicate white frond growing from the back of Connell's neck. Once, she thought those fronds were beautiful, but the woman said she could see what was happening through them. That means she saw, and did not stop, what Connell just tried to do. It infuriates Aislinn.
I thought you were my friend. You said you would help me.
The woman frowns, looking genuinely hurt and confused.
That's what I'm trying to do. That fellow. He's another city, and I hate him. Did he hurt you?
Your fellow?
Aislinn feels so stupid. Was the woman watching while Connell held on to Aislinn and invited her to suck his Nazi cock? Did she do nothing to help because it did not involve cities or boroughs or any of the other bizarre business that has taken over Aislinn's life?
In my house! In my own home!
Somehow, this is an extra bit of insult. In the meantime, the brown man has gotten out of the car and is walking toward them. He's taller than she realized at first, dressed in an open-jacketed dark suit with no tie, the cigarette a red warning at his mouth, and a business card held like a switchblade in his fingers. He radiates stylish menace, and with a deep chill, Aislinn realizes he isn't her, isn't part of New York. Whatever spell he wove before, which made her want to go with him, is gone. Now she can only think that he is bigger and stronger and a man and foreign. Aislinn backs away from him, too. The man reaches the asphalt and stops, on the other side of the patch of wavering fronds. The fronds twitch toward him at once, and he sucks smoke from the cigarette and blows it at them without looking. It's just cigarette smoke, as far as Aislinn can tell. But the white fronds react as if they've been attacked with chemical weapons. They lash away from him, squealing and shriveling. And within seconds, the remaining fronds have flattened, dead and fading rapidly from translucence into absence.
Amid the new silence, the three of them face each other in a triangle of tension. The woman is staring with wide, angry eyes at the brown man. Her head has tilted to one side, and Aislinn is amazed to note that her posture is defensive, almost frightened.
I'm getting very tired of you, São Paulo. We have had an understanding for thousands of years, says the man who isn't a man.
She's never heard of a city called São Paulo. Maybe it's African or in India. It sounds exotic like that. The pronunciation of São that the woman used is weird too. Something like song, all round and back of throat. The same nasal musicality is in the man's accent when he speaks.
Once a city has been born, your attacks end. Always before. This has been so.
The woman laughs a little.
Please. There was never any understanding. There can be no understanding because your kind don't understand anything.
Sal frowns at this, then tilts his head.
Oh, try me, he suggests. You never have before. You just tried to kill us. Of course we fought back. But if you can speak and if you are a person, then you can explain what you want. Maybe we don't have to fight.
The woman in white's face has become a study in incredulity.
What I want?
Her eyes narrow, even as she laughs.
Oh, sometimes I hate you people. One by one, you're fine. Better than fine, some of you are wonderful, so funny and peculiar. But there's a thing you always do, and I despise you for it. Did you really need to hear me speak to know that I was a person, São Paulo? Do people have to protest their own assault before you'll stop?
The man stiffens, and Aislinn does too at the word assault. But yes, it's there in his face amid the confusion and anger. Guilt. He did something, this brown foreign man. Something he felt entitled to do, maybe to the woman, maybe to some other woman. And all of a sudden, whether or not the woman has been complicit in what Connell did, Aislinn finds herself hating this São Paulo. It isn't personal. In this moment, Aislinn just hates all men who feel entitled to help themselves to things they shouldn't. So she glares at him. What do you want? São Paulo blinks away from the woman in white to focus on Aislinn, plainly surprised by her tone. Or maybe he did not expect someone like her to have voice enough to speak. Maybe he's Muslim or some other kind of woman-hating heathen barbarian.
I came to find you, he says.
His tone stays even, but she can tell he's puzzled by the question.
You and the others. The city requires your help to complete its maturation.
Well, I don't need your help, Aislinn snaps, so you can leave now.
He stares at her, and then he looks at the woman in white, his eyes narrowing in suspicion, as if he's trying to figure out whether the woman somehow made Aislinn say what she just did, as if he cannot believe that Aislinn is capable of speaking for herself. At which point, Aislinn is just done.
You don't belong here,
she snarls. Her hands have become tight fists.
Not in this city, not on my island. I don't need you. I don't want you here.
And because Aislinn is still deep in communion with her burrow, after tossing Connell through the fence, still thrumming with energy and anger and 30 years of suppressed fury, finally finding its outlet at last, she rejects São Paulo as fiercely as she did Connell. It shouldn't work. She's seen his other self, which is absolutely massive, bigger than the whole of New York. More importantly, he is whole and powerful in ways that New York is not. And yet, She is Staten Island. She stands upon her home ground, where he is an interloper, and he is far from the pollution-shrouded towers of his home city. So the wave of force that Island used on Connell ripples forth again. It catches the woman in white, who cries out and flings up her arms and suddenly vanishes, as quickly as she appeared. What stands in her wake is a pudgy, middle-aged woman with a spray tan and deep Clairol red hair, who blinks and looks dazed before turning away from them and starting to walk back toward the next neighborhood over, ignoring the whole tableau. But that was only collateral damage, because the woman in white was not Island's intended target. The wave of, "You don't belong here," hits Sao Paulo full force, and the effect is far worse than what she did to Connell, because Connell was, after all, just a man. Sao Paulo is blasted by this power as if by an invisible flamethrower, and she sees him take the blow in two ways at once. On one plane, he raises his arms as if to ward off Island's rage, and she sees the bones of his forearms snap just before he is lifted and flung off into the darkness beyond his parked car. In the other reality, she sees from up high, as an earthquake shivers its way across the greater metropolitan area of Sao Paulo. Older buildings fall, especially in some of the city's favelas. A quadruple-lane highway along the great city's flank splinters like bone, although thankfully it does not break apart entirely, which would spill hundreds of vehicles into the nearby river in a Williamsburgian echo of horror. Beyond that, it's bad, though. A city's commuter conduits are its lifeblood. For days, the 15 million citizens of Sao Paulo will struggle to work, to reach the hospital, to stay connected in all the myriad of ways that a city requires for health and life. In that other place, she sees girders blur and realizes that something flails toward her, though she gets the sense this is more reflex on Sao Paulo's part than malice. People who grow up fighting learn to hit back even as they're going down. Reflex or not, the strike lands, and in the other place, Island feels the rake of urban rail lines across her core, which slice through her like claws. They hurt. A deep and terrifying burn that seems to tear something inside of her. Not organs or tendons exactly, but something just as vital, though more existential. Her soul, maybe. She gasps and doubles over, clutching at her middle and blinking against pain tears. Instinctively, she knows that Staten Island has taken damage somewhere. Her island hurts with her. But Island is still standing, and Sao Paulo isn't. Island has subsisted for so long on mere survival that the endorphins, an elation of victory, of feeling strong, even for a minute, go right to her head. She starts laughing, despite the pain in her middle, and for a dizzying instant, she cannot stop. But then, slowly, she takes a breath, and then another, and forces herself to calm down. She sounds as crazy as the woman in white. She feels crazy. But she can also feel Sao Paulo still out there, wounded somewhere in the dark. So she forces herself upright, sucking air through her teeth to get past the pain, and calls after him. "Stay away from me, or us." It's not the most badass threat she could make, but he does not reply. Maybe he's unconscious or sulking. Doesn't matter. She won. Then Island staggers back toward the house, with her ribs aching and her skin flushed, and her thoughts bouncing around like Daffy Duck on a woohoo binge. The house is lit up when she gets there, but her father is in the backyard taking a statement from Connell. Two more cop cars pull up just as Aislinn climbs the front walkway, but the men inside don't seem to notice her as they stroll toward the backyard. Inside the house, Aislinn's mother is at the back door watching them. No one's thought to check on Aislinn, who's supposed to be upstairs safe asleep. So she simply slips up the stairs and goes to her room. With her window cracked for fresh air, she can distantly hear her father speaking with Connell in a raised voice. It sounds like he thinks Connell was drinking and threw the lounger through the fence himself. Connell is protesting this with equal loudness.
I'm telling you, I got jumped. It was a big black dude.
Aislinn is a little curious to know how the argument will resolve itself, even though she knows her father will soon go check the security videos and see Connell's big black dude, which is actually a 120-pound white woman overwritten by the illusion she fed the cameras. Some part of her still hopes.